Hello, it's Carmen Wong Ulrich, and here's your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of December 20th, 2013. So this show is about the choices that you make in life, how to not only get more money out of those choices, but more value. So this week in How We Live Money, the giving season is well upon us. However, what you give is not always what you get. How to make sure your charitable contributions work hard. Plus, financial planning for 20-somethings. But first up, let's address something you may be doing right now. Shopping. Now, Santa Sack, it's getting lighter because gift cards are now the gift of choice. According to the National Retail Federation, nearly 80% of holiday shoppers buy one. And listen, as with anything that's plastic, it's complicated. Consumer advocate Bob Sullivan is here with some scoop. He is the author of Stop Getting Ripped Off. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Bob, so here's the thing. You can get gift cards everywhere and anywhere, from the drugstore to online. They're just all over the place, but they are not all created equal.
That's absolutely true. Not all magnetic stripes are the same. And in some cases, you might be giving a gift to someone and think you're giving them, you know, a pretty nice $50, $100 gift, but by the time they use it wrong, it's going to be worth half that much. So it's really important how you buy a gift card.
Well, you said they use it wrong. What's using it wrong?
Well, the rules, of course, are made up by the companies that sell them, and they're in very, very tiny print that you might need a magnifying glass to read. So here's a couple of examples of using it wrong. You might wait a couple of months to use it wrong, in which case there are fees that start to pile up as time goes by. If you wait over a year, the value of some kinds of gift cards literally dribbles out of the gift card until it hits zero. So it is possible to give someone a gift card and have it be worthless to them by the time they try to use it.
Well, I thought that the Card Act, that lovely Card Act of 2009, the rules about plastic change. So a gift card shouldn't lose its value, but it can now simply through fees.
That's right. And it protected some kinds of gift cards, not others. So the simple rule of thumb is this. If your card is from a store directly, if you buy a Home Depot card and you use it at Home Depot, there aren't fees on that card. But if you buy a more generic card, what we call a bank gift card, like a Visa, MasterCard, American Express brand card, those guys can still charge fees, and they sure do.
Oh, so you're saying, so it is better to get a store card versus a general card? Because I think a lot of folks don't necessarily know what store to go to, so they just fall back on, and I raise my hand because I'm mildly guilty of that, on an American Express, a MasterCard, a Visa, one of those very generic cards. But you say that those have fees. Now, are there fees on both sides? So do I pay a fee and the person who receives it also pays a fee?
You could pay $60 for a $50 card, and it could be worth only $40 to the person who you give it to. So you're really giving a gift to the bank, not to the person you intend to give the gift to. But let me cut you off right there, because a lot of people will say they prefer to get these generic cards because they can use them anywhere. And why, oh why, oh why, don't they just give cash instead? Because, you know, cash,
right.
It always fits. You can use it anywhere. It's not rejected anywhere, except on airplanes in some cases. And, boy, it always makes me smile. If you feel bad about it, there's a social convention that says don't give cash. Get a card with one of those little money holders in it. It's perfectly classy. And you won't be giving the bank any money. You'll actually be giving something of exact value to the person who you love.
Well, Bob, I absolutely sympathize with that because I do believe, yeah, cash, there's no cost to cash. However, I will call it the cost of convenience. So for example, for my nieces, I will give them a gift card and they can then just enter the numbers online to buy something. So it's kind of more that we are now such a cashless society that, you know, I wonder if we're just paying the price for convenience for those cards.
We're certainly paying the price for convenience. And there's a little bit of possibility that you might lose the cash, but have some electronic record and be able to preserve a lost gift card.
And then here, I got to ask you this question, Bob, because this is one of those little tricks of finance. What is the difference between a gift card and a prepaid card? Because I do not see one.
There isn't. It's just a branding difference, although prepaid cards... I used to say without reservation that those have far higher fees. Their prepaid cards, for the most part, are designed for folks who don't have access to traditional credit cards or the banking system in general. But to tell you the truth, in the last 12 to 18 months, prepaid cards have actually become a better deal. So you might think to give a prepaid card, say, to a college student nephew or niece as a sort of allowance that you might give them, you know, I'll give you $50 a month for the next 5 months. That's kind of a clever way to give a gift to a kid. But prepaid cards, it's the same sort of magnetic stripe as a gift card.
And the same rules, pretty much, right? So that's individual to the card.
Same rules, and every single card has a different set of fees. You might have fees just for looking up your balance, for heaven's sake. So there are good cards and bad cards.
No.
Very important to figure. Yeah, yeah. Make a phone call. Boy, that's triple the fees. So yeah, before we forget, though, there is one deal that I think is worth examining. Some of the bigger stores like Costco or Sam's Club actually do offer certain limited kinds of gift cards that you can buy at a decent discount. So here you should expect something like, for $80, you can get two $50 gift cards that you can give to someone. So for $80, you get $100 worth of for dinner at a restaurant. That's about the best kind of discount that you can get, and it's from a major store, so it's pretty safe. Again, the selection of restaurants will be limited, but if it's a decent place that you know your friends would like to go to, that's a pretty good gift, and you'll save yourself 20%.
Wow, 20%. That's some big plastic savings in there. So Bob, you know what? Next year, I think I'm going to go with cash for the nieces. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Cash is always welcome in my mail, so thank you.
Bob Sullivan is the author of Stop Getting Ripped Off. If you have a question about gift cards or if you want to send us a note about your experience with this kind of plastic, head over to marketplacemoney.org. This is Marketplace Money from APM. So the land of discount shopping, though lovely, is now a crowded and noisy place. Coupon codes, in-store discount offers, price comparison sites. Yes, yes, they help us save some big bucks. But how do you know you're doing it all right and saving as much as you possibly can? Well, RetailMeNot.com is the grandpa of discount sites because they've been around now for several years. Here with some inside scoop on how we can save even more is Brian Hoyt. He's their senior writer and head of communications. Thank you for joining us, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Carmen.
So, Brian, here's the thing. The landscape has changed. I mean, I've been reporting on you guys since you started, and now you're kind of, you know, you're not the new kid on the block.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's only been since 2009 that RetailMeNot has been a business. Online couponing was largely very e-commerce focused, but there has been an explosion in mobile activity in the last, 24 months or so. By the end of 2011, we saw single digits of our traffic coming through mobile channels. At the end of the last quarter that we reported in 2013, we saw that nearly half of our traffic was now coming through a mobile channel. And that has really changed our business from being primarily e-commerce focused to being a major channel for brick and mortar retailers as well to reach consumers who are carrying that mobile phone in their pocket. And it's effectively a computer in their pocket that's become a new marketing channel for many retailers.
So, Brian, explain a little bit for the folks out there who don't use their phones for coupon hunting or for price comparison. You know, so how does that work and how can folks use their phones to save money in store, in person?
What companies like us are doing is we have a free app. You can get it on iTunes or Android, and you can look for coupons for free as well from thousands of stores out there. And what they're doing is when they're standing in the mall, they're kind of walking into the mall, they're getting automatically prompted. Apps like ours provide coupons for hundreds of merchants within that store. And so it's encouraging consumers to kind of stay in the mall and to shop in store just as much as they've been shopping online.
Yeah, and that's the big pressure, right, for the retailers is to make sure that though you're there physically, that you're not just there culling information and then leaving and shopping someplace else. Is there any other pushback that the retailers are giving, or is this all advantageous for consumers to get these automatic prompts in store?
Retailers know that smart couponing strategies can be profitable for them. It can help consumers, you know, purchase new products that they want to trial. It can help them move excess inventory. Smart couponing strategies generally lead to incremental purchases for a retailer.
How can people do this more efficiently? What are some key things that you need to know if you're out there and you're like, I'm going to shop both online and in-store and I want to save money? What's the best way to go about it for me?
You can always do the kind of price comparison shopping things online that help you find out where is the best price to get that. But don't forget to take the extra 30 seconds. And that's literally how long it takes. You have to go to the search bar when you come to our site and write in Macy's or write in Best Buy and see if that maybe second tier price that you looked at on that price comparison site, the one who came in second place, sometimes has a coupon that actually makes them the cheapest place in the marketplace to get a deal. And that's the power of the internet, right? I mean, we saw this happen in travel where you went from your travel agent to an online travel company like Orbitz.com. Or you saw this happen in music when you were standing inside one of the old record stores like The Wiz back in New York, and there are thousands of albums around you. Now you can go to iTunes and sample in a very efficient way.
A lot of folks are really worried about or talk about when they make their purchases. Should you consider timing as well when you go in and you want to save money with coupons or price comparison?
The holiday shopping season is pretty standard year after year. We tend to see certain bits and pieces of items be put on sale during certain periods of time. It starts earlier and earlier every year. We saw in one of the last surveys that we did that about 40% of consumers said they started shopping for the holidays prior to October. The old saying is that Labor Day is the new Black Friday, and it's true in many ways because you'll see a lot of consumer electronics and apparel items go on sale right at the end of back to school. During the kind of October period, you see apparel again continues to be something that's easily restocked, but toys and home decor, those products go on sale early. And home decor because, you know, maybe your family's coming over for Thanksgiving and you want to replace your mixing bowl. Or you want to replace an oven or an appliance and something big like that. And so you'll see like the Home Depots and the Lowe's in October push really great offers for consumers.
Brian Hoyt is the head of communications for RetailMeNot. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Carmen, for having us.
And how do you save money when you shop? Write us your tips at marketplacemoney.org or tweet us at LiveMoney. Coming up, a competition in love and money. How sometimes the best advice is permission to spend.
You might need to do something fun with your money, too. So make sure you're maxing out your retirement accounts. But the extra money that you have, maybe you guys should go somewhere really nice for your honeymoon.
A little reminder to live in the present. Listener questions and more next on Marketplace Money from APM. You know, we're all jingle bells these days, but financial planning, it rarely takes a break in your life. And there's a lot at stake, even if you don't have much money to plan with yet.
Carmen.
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 Carmen, what's going on?
Lots going on. It's time to answer your money questions. Now, we get a lot of them from those of you in your 20s. You're about to graduate college, join the workforce, maybe getting ready to settle down. All big deals for your money. And joining me today is Lauren Lyons Cole. She's a certified financial planner, and she specializes in financial coaching for young adults and couples. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks so much for having me, Carmen.
We know that youngins, we're all young at heart, right? Millennials are really entering a hard workforce. So not a ton of jobs, not a ton of earning, but man, those student loans are a huge, huge burden. And it seems like generation after generation, this is a growing financial issue.
Absolutely true. I mean, we're definitely seeing more people graduating with student loans. And, you know, the old rule of thumb used to be don't take out more in student loans than you can expect to earn your first year salary out of college. And a lot of people are coming out with twice that amount these days. So it's certainly an issue. And I think it's something for those who are coming out with student loans, we need to do a little bit of damage control, a little bit of calm down. It's okay. Here's a strategy so they feel more confident paying down that debt. And also for those going into college, maybe we can be a little bit more proactive in making sure that they're taking out a reasonable amount of student loans.
Yeah, because now we are over the $1 trillion mark.
It's crazy.
Right now for student loans. And it really is, you know, that's where we were with credit cards. Now credit cards have shrunk, actually. And the student loan debt just bubble keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
The other thing that's interesting in line with what you're saying is, you know, for those of us who are going to take out a mortgage on a house, we're not going to just take out a huge amount of money and say, wait. I need a little bit more. Give me more. It's going to be attached to the value of the home. And with student loans, we're just, you know, churning through the money that we're taking. And when we run out, we get more. And if we have to go to a private lender, we go to a private lender. And then you get out and look backwards. And that's when people are going, whoops.
That is an excellent analogy. Really, it is. Because you have to tie the student loans to the value of the degree and the potential you have for earnings, just like a home. So let's bring in some of our listeners here. We've got Hudson. Hudson is calling us from Detroit, Michigan, graduating in a week with a degree in market research. Now, Hudson is 26, looking at a yearly salary between 45, 55. But look at this, Lauren, about 100K in loans. Hudson, talk to us about your situation.
Yeah, so like you said, I just graduated with my master's degree, and the student loans are basically a combination of undergrad and graduate studies. And so I'm just trying to look at how should I pay them off? Should I pay off the higher interest rates ones first, or should I pay off the lower interest rates ones first, pay off the higher principal first? What strategy should I take with that is really what I'm trying to figure out.
Lauren, what do you think?
Well, first of all, congratulations on graduating. And I'm glad to hear that that student loan debt is a combination of undergrad as well as your master's degree, because, you know, that it explains a little bit more. If it were just a master's degree, that would be quite a chunk. And the good news is, in market research, from what I know about the field, you do have long-term high earning potential, especially if you work hard and if you're, you know, willing to relocate. There are jobs out there that are paying over $100,000 for sure in this field. What I would really recommend in paying down these student loans and looking at the interest rates that we know you have, you know, ranging between 3.4% to 5.6%, those are not bad interest rates. And so coming out, you may be able to do a little bit of loan consolidation, definitely worth looking into just to simplify your life. But I'm going to tell you, just pay the minimums for now. Whatever you're doing, just pay the minimums and get yourself started on some other goals, right? So start saving for retirement. Prioritize some of these other things. And as your income increases, don't get the fancy car. Don't take, you know.
Not with this much in loans, that's
no.
For sure.
Wait till the loans are underneath, you know, what your annual salary is. So when you get a bit of balance, then you can start shopping around. But, you know, make sure that you're not overwhelming yourself with this debt at the expense of other goals.
And Hudson, let me ask you, so monthly payments on six figures in loans, what are you looking at as a monthly payment, a minimum?
Bare minimums, I think I calculated out to maybe around $750 or so.
Wow. Because, Lauren, here's the thing. So, Hudson, you're going to be earning, you know, around $50 after taxes. That is huge. So should Hudson be looking at an income-based repayment program? And maybe we should explain to him what that is and to our listeners.
Yeah. So an income-based repayment plan, if you do have federal loans, you could opt to do an income-based repayment plan. And I got to be honest, you may have to. I don't know that you're going to have the money to make the full payment right away. You know, and a lot of times my advice, especially to young people, is do the income-based repayment plan if you have to. That makes your loans more expensive over time, decreases your payments now, and it ties the monthly payment to your income so that it's not more than you can bear to pay, but it does increase the amount of interest paid over the life of the loan because you're paying over, you know, 25 years. So it's a good option for right now because you might have to do that.
Hudson, how do you see that outlook? I mean, in terms of paying that much a month in loans, were you going to do anything big like, you know, live with family so you didn't have to pay rent? How are you planning on making that monthly payment?
Yeah, well, I was just kind of calculating it out on a spreadsheet. And basically, if I can keep like the rent down, rent in our section of the country isn't too bad if you know where to look and that kind of thing. If you want to sacrifice a few other maybe comforts in life, it can kind of be done.
And what do you think about basically tying the payments, monthly payments, to how much you earn, which would make your monthly payments smaller, but it would cost you more? Or do you think that you want to stick with paying these minimum payments to stick to your original agreement on the loan?
Well, I am definitely aware of that option, and that would definitely work for me. Like you said, in my field, you do start out a little bit mid-income, but you can, within just a few short years, be earning a lot of money close to the, you know, 90, 100 pay range. So, I mean, if I could just take it slow now and then just kill them later, it would probably work.
Yeah, and you know what? You want to go to, you want to head over to FinAid, FINAid.org, and you want to look up the income-based repayment program there to look at all the rules. Hudson, do you know if all of your loans are federal or private?
Yes, they're all federal. They're all Stafford and graduate federal loans.
Is it Lauren and I just like wiped our brow in relief because, Lauren, private loans are deadly, right?
They certainly can be. I mean, sometimes with private loans, you'll end up with a lower interest rate, but that's because interest rates are low right now. If things change in the future, these can really end up being a problem. So I'm really glad to hear you have all federal loans. In fact, you know, a loan consolidation may very well be your best bet just because it makes life easier. You can put it on autopilot, stop thinking about it, and just, you know, focus on your job, which, you know, is the whole reason you went to school.
All right, Hudson, what do you think? You're going to kick it out at work and get rid of this debt, yeah?
Absolutely.
All right, my friend, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I love your show. Appreciate it. Thanks for taking
the
call.
All right, thanks. And also we have an email here, Lauren, from Amy from Minneapolis, and she writes, we desperately need to get on track with our family budget in 2014. What's your recommendation on how to start, budget app, computer program? And here's a good part of her question. How do you keep it going for the whole year? And I'll add to Amy's question, year after year after year. What's worked best for you and your clients?
That's such a good question. And I got to tell you, this is the one secret that has worked for me and has worked for everyone that I've ever helped develop this habit. And that is tracking your income. A lot of people go immediately to the budget. So people say, you know, I'm going to spend only $300 a month on groceries and I'm going to keep my gas costs low and everything. And you can't always put limits on your spending. And a lot of times we put the wrong limit because we're completely out of touch with what reality is. So if you just start by tracking your expenses, which is very easy to do, everybody with or without a financial planner can track their expenses. I'm a little crazy. I've done it for, I think, 12, 13 years now. So I've got, it's a really interesting history of my spending going back on, you know, in time. But that allows me, no matter how my income has changed, because incomes go up, they go down, I've always been on top of what it is that I'm actually spending on. So I've known when it's time to cut back. That's a really big tip for me. Track your spending. But the other thing that's sort of in line with that, if you do want to give a framework or structure to your budget, always, always, always make a category for unexpected expenses. Because I love this. People are like, well, I know I was sticking to my budget, but then the
car broke down.
Yes.
The car broke down. The pop-up expenses, I call them.
The pop-up expenses. But here's the thing. They happen every single month.
This is a very personal question because, you know, she's asking, Amy's asking, well, is it an app? Is it a program? You know, for some folks, for example, for me, you know, if I were to do some kind of app that tracked what I ate, I think I tried this once. It worked for half a day. Like, you have to actually go in and write. These things don't work for me. So I would recommend to Amy as well to just think about how she best functions. Maybe she should just write it down with a pen and pencil. Yeah. Maybe it's an Excel spreadsheet. Maybe it is an app. But it really depends on how your preferences in terms of tracking and managing money and time. Now listen, stay with us, Lauren. We're going to be back with another question from a listener after this short break. This is Marketplace Money, and my guest this hour, helping to answer your questions, is Lauren Lyons-Cole. She's a certified financial planner who specializes in personal finance coaching for young adults and couples. Lauren, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So now we're going to go to Kate in Chicago, Illinois. Kate is 24 years old. Law school, Lauren, law school. We know the price tags, you know, are going here. Second year, and she has a future husband, a fiancé, who's 31, and he is a photo stylist for Pottery Barn. Now, that's a job for you. Mm-hmm. Now, they live together. Kate, you've got some questions, however, because you guys have a little bit different style when it comes to money.
Yeah, we do have a slightly different style just because we're in such different parts of our lives. I'm really not earning any money. I have a small PA job that pays maybe $300 a month, but not very much. And he's been working for a while and has a 401k and has savings. And so we're starting to have conversations about where we should go in terms of combining bank accounts, in terms of planning for our future, and just need some advice.
Well, I'll tell you, Kate, you're 24, right? And your fiance is 31.
Mm-hmm.
Those 7 years are like dog years, okay? When you're in your 20s, the difference between 24 and 31 is like a 20-year gap when it comes to your finances. Am I right, Laura?
It's so true. That's exactly what was going through my mind, too.
So don't be too hard on yourself. So let's help Kate get back on track here. Though their finances are very different right now, Kate, should you secure? You're looking for a legal job, right, once you're done?
Right. Well, I have a job coming up in the summer that's working for a big firm. So it's going to my pay raise is going to go up a lot over the summer. I'm going to be making way more money, and then it's going to go back down my third year and hopefully back up again after I graduate. So that's another concern, because my bank account right now has a very low deposit limit. So I'll have to change anyway. So I'm wondering if we should just combine.
Ooh, Lauren, do they combine accounts? So this is a doozy.
This is. And when is the wedding? Is it coming up soon?
Wedding's in October.
Next October.
Okay.
But she's not married to her bank.
Right.
So you know. Just so you know. As you noted, Kate, in your letter to us, you said, I'm not married to my bank.
Right.
I personally would not recommend combining accounts prior to getting married or to having some sort of legal relationship. But I do think it sounds like it's time for you to change banks. One thing I really like, especially young people tend to adopt this technique easier than older people sometimes, but there's so many good online banks. And, you know, for me and actually for my partner, we use an online bank. We each have separate individual accounts, and he's actually got a brick and mortar bank that he uses. I have an online bank. And then we have a combined joint account that we both deposit money into on a monthly basis for our joint expenses that we pay together. And we transfer that money proportionally to our income. So that's something that you guys could consider doing as well.
Yeah. I mean, right now I definitely use my mobile banking. I can't even remember the last time I stepped into a bank and actually talked to someone.
Exactly.
Well, right. I know. Exactly. But that's a good way to go, because Kate, one thing is, you know, a lot of these online banks, Lauren, they are no fee, and some even pay some interest. So she should shop around and find that. But to your point, Lauren, about having that one, you know, household account and then having your individual accounts, Kate, I've been giving advice for a long time. And I can tell you that this is the system that works really well, both for people who really respect that you're partners in life, you know, and a team, but also that you're grown-ups and you want to have some of your own money. Do you think your fiancé would be cool with that?
I definitely think he would. I mean, we both are pretty open about money stuff, and we don't really guilt each other about what we buy. But at the same time, we realize that sometimes we need a little bit of freedom to make our own choices.
Yeah.
In terms of discretionary spending.
And Kate, I got to ask you, because I sensed such agita when you're talking about, oh, I'm so far behind and he's got all this stuff and I'm so far behind. Lauren, what can we tell her to make her feel like she's on top of things?
So the best thing you can do once you start earning, max out your retirement right away and just don't even think about it. Do it forever. You just start immediately.
Just forever.
Forever.
Ever.
Until you retire. And you're going to be in a good position in the long run. He might even be, you know. You might even end up ahead. Who knows?
Oh, this is not a competition, people.
No, it's true.
This is not But there's nothing wrong with a little healthy competition as long as it motivates you. And Kate, you are ahead of the game because you are a law student, a rare bird, who has no student loans.
Yeah, I really lucked out in that respect.
That's
I was able to
work
out my financial situation with scholarships. So I don't have to worry about that as much. And to my fiance's credit, too, he's obsessed with maxing out his 401k, and he's in a great position. And he's always sort of told me that he wishes he had realized that earlier and suggested that, you know, I do the same.
See, Kate, there's one way that you beat him. You're younger. You have the years. You have the time. You're getting started at the right time. Because this is one of those things, Lauren, that I tell folks that when they're young, right? And they're like, oh, retirement's so far away and I can't even save. The power of time is brilliant. And Kate, your fiance recognizes that in some ways you're ahead of the game.
Yeah, he's super lucky.
Yes, I'm sure he is. Oh, my goodness.
Kate, you know, one thing, just as I'm listening to you, I'm sort of thinking that you guys need a joint checking account, but I'm also thinking you need a joint savings account. You both sound so responsible that I'm thinking you might need to do something fun with your money, too. So make sure you're maxing out your retirement accounts. But the extra money that you have, maybe you guys should go somewhere really nice for your honeymoon or something like that.
Listen to that.
That's permission a really good idea.
Permission to spend, Kate. Permission to spend. Okay? And I'm telling you right now, if there's one thing that I love, and Lauren, I love that you said this, is that you can talk about scrimping and saving and retirement and all this thing all you want, but if you are not enjoying your life in some way and you don't give yourself room to breathe, it's all for naught. We also have to live in the present. And Kate, I too give you permission to spend some money on that honeymoon and enjoy yourselves and enjoy each other. What do you think?
I'm totally sold. I'm going to start saving right now.
I believe that.
I believe that too. And you know what, Lauren? I love that they are mildly competitive because this is a situation where that nice little friction can really get them somewhere together.
Totally true.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the advice.
And Lauren, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always fun, Carmen.
Lauren Lyons Cole, you can find her at laurenlyonscole.com. She's a personal finance expert and a certified financial planner. And if you have a question that you want us to tackle, head over to marketplacemoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. So we wanted to make a clarification from last week's show. We had on financial educator Galia Guichon, and we were talking about funding your retirement when you're self-employed. And we wanted to clarify, when it comes to a solo 401k, the maximum contributions for 2013 is $51,000, and for 2014, it's $52,000. Now, you can add in more money if you are older, but if you want to find out more information and your contribution limits, go to irs.gov. Next, the art of the ask, why we donate and how to do it right.
Most people are just reacting to solicitations. And if something comes in that you think looks good or your friend is giving to, maybe you're going to give to it.
Oh, there are so many ways to give this season. Tipping, tipping, and more tipping. The etiquette behind a growing holiday tradition. These stories coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. You know, we started the show looking at one way that we're spending our money for the holidays, shopping. But another way we tend to spend this time of year is giving to charity. Here to talk about why we give and how is Harvard Business Professor Michael Norton. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you do a lot of work on giving and charity and how it can make you happy, possibly. We know that this time of year, about 25% of all the giving through the year, all the charitable donations, happens during the holidays. Why do we really do that?
I think there are many, many reasons why people give right around the holidays. The kind of selfish or self-centered reason is, of course, because we're trying to get our tax rebates before we miss the deadline. But even when we do it for those sorts of reasons, our research shows that people actually feel happy after they do it. So some people give because they have the holiday spirit. Some people give for more practical reasons. But almost regardless of why we do the giving, it ends up really giving us a warm glow after we do it.
Well, and you know, this time of year, too, it seems like there are more opportunities or the opportunities present themselves to you to give. So from, you know, the Salvation Army in front of the local store or a friend or a colleague, office mate, you know, raising funds. So there's a lot of ask going on right now. How much does that influence giving?
It has an enormous influence, actually. So if you think about the times that you give, a huge percent of all of our giving is done because a specific person looks us in the face or sends us an email and says, I'm running a race, I'm ringing a bell, and we feel a little bit bad, and that's why we give. The nice thing is, though, even though sometimes we're grumpy when we give because we're cursing while we write a check, still when we write that check, it's still better than not having written it because in the end, we're going to feel like we did a good thing and we're going to be a little bit happy.
So you're saying that at the front of it is us feeling guilty for giving, but you see that that actually changes, the guilt changes once the giving is given.
That's right. And if you think about the stress of buying gifts for people around the holidays and standing in these lines and pushing and shoving and all the horrible things that happen, again, you get this payoff at least when you give the gift to someone and you see their face light up because you thought of them and you took time. And in fact, the more you stood in line and it was a hassle, sometimes the more they appreciate the gift because you really went to an effort. And the more you feel like, I must really care about this person because I waited in line for 80 minutes when I was swearing at everybody and I still stuck it out. I guess I really love my partner.
Oh, Michael, I love everybody, but I still just buy online very quickly. But I love everybody.
Much smarter.
But, you know, in terms of how much we give, particularly this time of year, so you mentioned the face-to-face interaction and that basically having more success in terms of separating you and your money. But, you know, how do we decide how much to give? Because a lot of the research shows that folks who actually make less money give a larger percentage of their income to charity than folks with much more money.
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, if you look at the relationship between percent of your income given to charity, it turns out that very poor people give a high percent. It's really middle class people that are quite low. And then very, very wealthy people, again, give a fairly high percent of their income to charity. You can think of lots of reasons for why that might be. But one clear reason is just poor people, first off, they experience need themselves and they're surrounded by people in need. And a big part of why people give is they're exposed to someone who's in need. And we're built in a way that when we see someone who's in need, we really feel like we should do something about it. If we don't see them every day, though, we can forget in a weird way that people are in need and not act. But when confronted with someone in need, we do act. And this is why we see these ads on TV and in magazines with a child who really looks like they're in need. It's very hard for us, even though it's a child in another country or even just a picture, it's very hard for us to turn off our emotional reaction to that. It really spurs us to act.
Well, Michael, that's a fantastic segue because my next question is going to be about how social media and our global media in general really has influenced and changed the way we give, because we see those images, for example, from the Philippines. We hear the news and we feel some more connectivity, yes? Or is it just about we have the information?
I think sometimes social media can help us feel more connected to distant causes, in part because we do have more information. Our friends are informing us about what's happening in other countries. We can also use the internet to really figure out which charities are better and worse at solving different problems. There's a worry with social media, though, which is that sometimes when we engage on Facebook with charities, we click the like button for the American Red Cross, and we feel like we've done something good for the world. But we forget after we click the like button to actually go and give money to the Red Cross to help them help people in other countries. So I think there's pluses and minuses to the shift to online giving that really research is just starting to uncover.
So the fact that we like a charity instead of giving money, we actually still feel in some way that we've given something, support.
We do. And it's the same way if I said publicly, you know, I really care about people. I might feel like I did a good thing, except the way that you really care about people is go do somebody a favor or go help somebody out. It's very important that we not just say or click, but actually do.
Professor Michael Norton is Associate Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School and author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen.
The professor of giving has spoken. Well, now it's time to get practical. How to figure out where to give and how much. Eileen Heisman is the CEO of the National Philanthropic Trust, and she's an ambassador for hashtag Giving Tuesday. What is that? Well, Giving Tuesday is a Twitter-based movement to start a national day of charitable giving at the beginning of the holiday season. This year, it was on December 3rd. Welcome, Eileen.
Thank you for having me.
So, Eileen, I love Giving Tuesday, but maybe for some folks who are just kind of approaching this season of charity and doing this for the first time or encountering all the technology or saying, how do I give this time of year with all these solicitations? And what's the best way to give?
I think the question of who to give to and how do you decide is actually a good one, because I think most people are just reacting to solicitations. And if something comes in that you think looks good or your friend is giving to, maybe you're going to give to it. But I think another way to think about it is to suggest to make a list of things that are really important to you. It might be something your family's gone through or a friend or an experience you've had in your life with the arts or a healthcare issue. And then decide that that's an important issue to you, and then do some research and look up some charities that do work in that area, and then see who's funding them and see what kind of projects they're involved with and see if it resonates with you. And then you need to step back and decide how much money you want to give, because if you don't have a lot of money, $20 may be your budget, or it may be $2,000, and for some people, $2 million. So depending on your budget, you may want to decide to give it to a few charities or just one charity, but think carefully about what they're doing with it and whether there's going to be impact from the gift that you're giving.
Yeah. And speaking of impact, Eileen, you know, there's been a lot of focus lately, and especially the past couple of years, on the administrative costs of a charity and how effective. So for each dollar you give, you know, what percentage goes to run the charity versus actually going to help folks? Is that the right way to choose a charity?
I think overhead is one element you should look at, but I think you need to look at a lot of other things as well. You need to look at the kind of cause they're trying to support. If it's a mission's complicated, it might require more overhead. If it's a brand new organization, they might have an overhead that looks perhaps a little high to you. So you need to do your own individual research about looking at the mission, who's in the leadership role, how long they've been around, the kind of reputation they have, and to read some of the statistics on your own and not just rely on an overhead ratio, because it's very deceiving and sometimes can steer you away from a charity that's doing a great job.
Is it more effective then, let's say if you have a decent budget, to spread your money around, or should there be this very focused strategy and budget that you kind of stick to every year? What's the most effective way to use that money?
I think you should have two budgets. You know, divide your number in half, or maybe one quarter, three quarters. And three quarters you can plan for, and you should pick maybe three organizations or three causes that are really important to you and make fewer larger gifts. So instead of sprinkling a lot of small numbers around, you know, maybe $50, $100 here and there, you know, decide to concentrate your giving in a few areas. And then stay with those charities for a while. It actually costs charities a lot of money to find new donors, and if they can count you as a loyal donor with a larger gift, you're actually saving them overhead, and more money will go to programs. And that's really important in this sector. And then the other part of your budget, the smaller one, might be for disaster giving. It seems in the last several years, we've had an amazing number of natural disasters. Save some money for the disaster giving. And I suggest when you're going to do disaster giving to not give immediately the day or two after the disaster, but wait for a week, 2 weeks, maybe even a month, because some of the most complicated problems that arise after disaster are infrastructure rebuilding, and often organizations don't know how they're going to do that.
Now, you know, we've been talking about cash donations here, but what about, you know, for example, I moved this year and I had a lot of furniture to donate. Folks have other assets as well, whether it's real estate or it's stock. What's some advice in terms of giving non-cash gifts at the end of the year?
One of the best ways to give at the end of the year, if you have appreciated securities, you know, stock that's been in the stock market and it's gone up and you've held it for longer than a year, is to actually gift the securities themselves. So you don't sell them and then pay capital gains tax and then gift the proceeds. You actually gift the actual securities to the charity, and therefore you avoid capital gains tax, and you get the full fair market value of the stock. So if you got the stock for $10 and it's worth $100, you can take the deduction of $100. In that case, the charity sells the stock, and then they use it for whatever purposes you've intended to gift it for.
A lot of fantastic information. Eileen Heisman is the CEO of the National Philanthropic Trust. Eileen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Carmen. Nice to talk to you.
And head online to marketplacemoney.org to get more tips on how to give right. This is Marketplace Money from APM. So you think we got giving covered? We got one more. tipping. Now, you may be happy to show some extra gratitude to the helpful folks in your life, the folks who cut your hair, take care of your kids, walk your dog, but you have a budget. We all have a budget. That's why I'm joined by etiquette expert Mr. Manners, Thomas Farley. Great to have you, Thomas.
Carmen, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Thomas, I got to talk to you because I'm telling you, tipping is now one of the biggest parts of my holiday budget. And I don't think it's just because I live in a city. I think this is happening more and more. I'm hearing it from folks in the suburbs. They're getting asked to tip by daycare providers, by people, everybody that you come in contact with. Is this a new thing?
Well, it's not new, but it's definitely cropping up in more places and all year long. So something like the tip jar is a trend that 5 years ago you wouldn't have seen a tip jar anywhere. Now they're everywhere. So the thing people really have to bear in mind is it's not the time that they have to worry about going bankrupt. You tip what you can, and you tip the people who've really helped you throughout the year. But nobody should ever feel a tip is something that is an absolute obligation.
Yeah, and it is one of those things. It's almost like, for example, with the daycare provider, you almost feel like, if I don't tip, she won't get the attention she deserves. You know, it feels like always this weird blackmail that's going on. If I don't tip the newspaper guy, he'll throw my paper into the ditch. You know, so there is that feeling now, which I don't think I've seen at this level before, that people really expect you to tip these days.
You're right. There definitely is that fear. And I think certainly for certain passive-aggressive individuals, that kind of thing may happen. But you'd like to hope that somebody, especially with the daycare example, that that person is going into the profession because they really do love children and they're doing it for the right reasons. If you feel you can't give anything, you really are just absolutely tapped out, you have no budget, you can still do something. So do a card. And if times are really tough and you've traditionally tipped and now you can't tip, you might want to just indicate in the card, you know what, this has been a really difficult year for me financially. I'd love to give to you as I have in the past. Unfortunately, I can't, but I hope you know that's not a reflection of the great job you're doing. Somebody getting a card like that is not going to have that resentment versus somebody who just gets nothing from you at all.
I think that's a really good idea because if somebody receives a card like that, they're a lot less likely to think that you're just stiffing them and you're being cheap.
Absolutely. And again, in the case of a daycare worker or a babysitter or a nanny, involve the child. So have the child do a homemade card too. That is something that's really special. What I do hear a lot from folks, and this is from teachers and dog groomers, is they don't want any more kitty-themed items as gifts. They don't want the, you know, the cute cat calendar if they're somebody who takes care of the cat. They want a gift card. They want the retail gift card or they want some money.
What are the odds the cat sitter would have a cat mug? Actually, pretty high, I would assume.
Well, they probably have one that they really like, but they don't need 50,
right?
Is the point.
So, and here's the thing, too, is that the more tips, the more that we're being asked to give tips, we all are asking each other, oh, well, how much should I give the doorman? How much should I give? How much are you giving? How much? So if you can't ask directly, who should you ask?
Well, so I think you're right. And certainly, and this is a very New York thing or a very urban thing where a building will give you a list of all the personnel in the building, which is not even just a so subtle hint, hint. This is a pretty much 2x4 over the head. Taking it from their perspective, let's face it, these are the people who are helping you excel throughout the year, look good. If it's, we're talking about the hairdresser, the person who's there in a pinch when, you know, your usual sitter cancels on you and need to get somebody at the last minute. These are the people who let you lead the lives that these busy lives that we all lead throughout the year. So it's definitely not a time to be stingy. And if you want them and are hoping that they'll continue to give you that extra, you giving the extra at the end of the year is really important. But in terms of finding your fact-finding mission, I think sometimes people feel a little bit on the spot if you ask them, hey, how much did you tip or how much do you? But what I would say is, you know, hey, we're new to this school. And of course, with a teacher, you wouldn't use the word tip. It's more of
a
gift.
Right.
But you'd say, you know, what's customary here? Because it's regionally appropriate situations. It's some, you know, a private school is going to be different from a public school. And maybe there's a group gift. You also have to be mindful there may be policies against giving a gratuity or giving a gift, and people can't accept. So those are all factors people have to consider.
So you have to be very careful with that. Now, here's a question, because you mentioned, you know, the salon, for example. So in situations where there's multiple people that you have contact with, but you usually have one particular person does your hair, but once in a while someone else will come in and shampoo. So it's, you almost feel, gosh, do I give to the whole place or just this person? How does that work?
Well, a nice thing, especially if it's there's not a dedicated person, what a nice thing for a lot of people to do is bring in something that can be shared by the entire team. So maybe it's a plate of fresh baked cookies or chocolates. Everybody loves food around the holidays. People are working extra hours. They need that sugar rush to keep going. So they may even remember your amazing chocolate chip cookies more than they're going to remember a few dollars here or there.
Exactly. Thomas Farley, thank you for your tips.
No pun intended. You can resist. Thank you, Carmen.
Thomas Farley is known as Mr. Manners. You can get him at Twitter at Mr. Manners and at whatmannersmost.com. Find more on tipping, charitable giving, holiday shopping deals, and student loan debt at our website, marketplacemoney.org. So that's our show for this week. But next time, returns and exchanges. How to make sure you get your money back, or at least get a sweater that you'll actually wear. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Candice Manriquez. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember to always check with your financial pro before making any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.